Josh Bell hates everything.
That's right, including your movie.
Josh Bell hates everything.
Except me.
Hello and welcome to the Josh Bell Hates Everything podcast. I'm Josh Bell, contributing editor and film critic for Las Vegas Weekly. And joining me this week is Matthew Scott Hunter, fellow film critic for Las Vegas Weekly. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Josh.
So let's start this week with Zach and Miri Make a Porno, which is Kevin Smith's new movie starring Seth Rogen and Elizabeth Banks as a pair of sort of slacker roommates, friends for life, secretly in love with each other. Of course, I don't think that's a big spoiler in this movie. They're very poor, and their utilities get shut off, and they decide that the way to make money is that they're going to make a porno.
We've all been there.
Yeah, I think so. This movie is very identifiable, really. So they gather a bunch of, you know, misfits and whatever, and they decide to make this porn, and they're going to make a Star Wars parody porn, but then that doesn't work out, and so they make just a sort of regular porn in the coffee shop where Zach works. And it's super predictable, I would say, this movie.
Yeah, I think it's a total formulaic romantic comedy.
Yes.
I think that, I mean, Kevin Smith, what's defined him is sort of the rough nature of his films. And as he's become more experienced, his movies lose that rough nature and just become sort of mainstream. This is the most mainstream film I think I've seen him make.
It's less mainstream than Jersey Girl, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, it's sort of the same. By the end, it's just it's one of those romantic comedies where you know, the guy and the girl like each other, and the reasons they're not together are completely contrived.
Sure.
And by the end, it got so frustrating. There were all these conversations where Seth Rogen would preface it by saying, "Can I talk to you for a second?" And of course, he doesn't want her to have sex with any of the other stars of the film.
And she doesn't want him
admit why, and
it's
annoying.
It is annoying. Well, see, I get the sense that you were irritated with this movie.
I was after a while. At first, I liked it. It's got that sort of, you know, pithy, you know, Kevin Smith dialogue at the beginning. And I like, you know, him setting up the characters and everything. And then the porn stuff. There are the Star Wars jokes, which I thought were kind of a missed opportunity there.
I mean, yeah, I didn't realize. I thought they were going to go ahead with the Star Wars porn. And then when this, all of a sudden they say, oh, it's not going to work out, and they have some financial problem, or I forget what it was. And that was a little disappointing, I think.
Yeah. And then by the third act, it's just a flat-out romantic comedy with occasional, you know, big breasts thrown in there. So.
Well, that's always nice to see.
Yeah, it helps.
But no, I mean, I like this movie. I think everything you're saying is true. It is very predictable. It is conventional romantic comedy structure, and you can kind of groan at a lot of the contrivances that they throw in the way of the romance between Zach and Miri. But at the same time, I thought it was funny, and especially because Kevin Smith has made some pretty crappy movies. I mean, I don't know. I definitely prefer this to Clerks 2.
Yeah, I prefer it to Clerks 2.
And certainly Jersey Girl, which I thought was awful.
Mm-hmm. I don't even remember it.
Which, you know, is probably, you're good for lucky. Kevin Smith. Yes, yeah. Yes, you're lucky. That was, I mean, that was so sappy. And even Clerks 2 has so many of those like really sappy scenes to it where they just kind of put the brakes on the humor and decide to like talk about their feelings.
Yeah, it gets really sentimental, and there's always like a quick fix in that scene. Like Zach and Miri get their power put back on before they've made any money from the porno. It's just like a quick fix so they can have a scene in their apartment, and then the way they inevitably reconcile. I don't think we're giving anything away there.
No, certainly not.
That's really contrived too. It's like everybody is suddenly so interested in making sure that they reconcile, and then you have this long drawn out.
Wouldn't you be? Wouldn't you want to see those two crazy kids get together?
Yeah, I don't know if I've gone to that great a length to make sure that my friends hook up. But.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I felt like this had a better balance of those elements of the humor and the sort of, you know, romantic, serious moments than something like Clerks 2 did. And I enjoyed myself throughout the movie, even as it sort of grinds through, you know, the obvious plot beats. I mean, it's a genre film in that sense, you know, just like a horror movie where you know certain people are going to die and, you know who's going to get killed. But at the same time, if it's well crafted, you can enjoy yourself. And I think this was well crafted enough in that it was a comedy and it was an actually funny comedy. I liked the characters. I wanted them to get together just like their friends did. You know, I was happy when they got together, even though it was stunningly obvious that it was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I still liked that. And so I did enjoy this movie.
I'd say I enjoyed most of it. The problem for me was that I laughed like 2/3 of the way through, and then in the final act there are so few laughs at that point. So
yeah,
that's sort of the impression that it left me with.
Right. I guess there were a few fewer laughs. And I don't know. I also feel like Seth Rogen is clearly just playing the same role over and over again at this point.
Hey, it's working for him.
And so. Right, it is working for him, but you know, you kind of have to wonder how much longer he can do that for.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are similarities to Judd Apatow films here. I think they're definitely with Seth Rogen's presence and, you know, that sort of sentimentality to it and the romance. I don't know.
And occasional scatological humor.
Well, right. Not that Kevin Smith hadn't also done scatological humor in the past, but it did seem to me a little bit like he was sort of grabbing on to something that someone else has done that's worked out and sort of incorporating it into his own style.
Maybe. I don't know. I think maybe if someone other than Seth Rogen had been cast, it might not seem that way. But that really, you know, seals the Apatow connection.
Right. I guess that's true. I didn't necessarily have a problem with it. Mm-hmm. But it seemed to me that, like, I mean, in a way, Kevin Smith is sort of growing. I mean, we can talk about, you say, his early movies are so rough. And one of the things, I mean, I think it's sort of charming in Clerks, but by the time you got to Dogma, which is a big, like, sort of metaphysical story, and he's still shooting it like it's two guys sitting in a convenience store where he can't cut. He just has to move the camera back and forth between the characters as they speak. I like that he's kind of figured out how to make it look slicker, you know?
Sort of. I think that he's, he was visually, he had no style whatsoever, and now his style is just functional. So,
right, it
makes
improves.
Him look like a normal filmmaker.
Right. It's not that, no, I don't think he's ever going to be some sort of visual stylist, but I think at least here, I think in the past it was sort of distracting the way that he was shooting in this so lo-fi, as if we can't even do two camera setups in this one scene sort of way. Mm-hmm. And now, like you said, yeah, it's just functional, but it doesn't distract you from the story or from the dialogue, I think.
Which Well, I think he's no longer the kid at the convenience store trying to shoot a movie with, you know, whatever money he can get, which kind of makes you demand more of him.
Right. That's true. And, I mean, he is that, like, I think it's good that he retains some of that sense of being the kid in the convenience store, because that's what we liked about him when he first came along. So I don't know. I mean, despite having mixed feelings, I did like this movie. I gave it 3 stars. I don't know how you seem like you would.
I'd give it 2.5.
2.5, yeah. All right, that's fair. I think for Kevin Smith fans especially, if you haven't liked what he's done recently, this is worth checking out.
Yeah.
So on to a completely different kind of movie, the new Clint Eastwood picture, Changeling, starring Angelina Jolie, based on a true story taking place in the late 1920s in Los Angeles, about a woman whose son was kidnapped, and the police returned or claimed to return her son to her, but of course they had found the wrong boy, and she insisted that this was the case, that they had not found her son, that they had returned someone else, and this sort of corrupt police department determined to not admit its mistakes, eventually threw her in a mental institution for, I guess it's about a week, a few days, something like that. And, this movie, I think, has a lot of, it's about a lot of different things. It's about a mother. Her son is kidnapped and she's worried and they're trying to find the kid. And then it's this sort of mental institution melodrama. And then she gets out of the mental institution and it becomes this sort of courtroom drama.
Yeah, in the last 20 minutes, the movie becomes like about 6 more things. So.
Right. It is, I mean, I think it's sticking to a true story, so you kind of are stuck with the facts, and I don't know how closely it sticks, but I imagine it's relatively accurate. So maybe it's hard to criticize it for its structure, but it did seem to me that this movie was a little unfocused.
Yeah, well, I think it gradually becomes unfocused. At first, it is sort of concentrating just on Angelina Jolie's struggle and the corruption of the police department. But and then just as I was getting sort of tired of just seeing her look weepy,
she is very weepy.
She's very weepy in the movie. But just as I was getting tired of that, they sort of bring in the subplot with the with what's actually happening to these abducted children.
Right.
And that sort of unfolds in this police procedural sort of way. But I thought it was entertaining and changed things up just in time. To me, though, the movie's about these two things most of the way through. And then about 25 minutes before it's over, both of these stories sort of wrap themselves up.
Right.
And then there's another 25 minutes of aftermath.
Yeah, there is a lot. And scenes that sort of don't seem to be that germane to what the movie's about thematically, which I think is, you know, about how the system sort of disregards women in this era, that because Angelina Jolie she's a single mother and she's a woman, that they sort of discount the things that she says when she says, "Oh, this is not my son." And the doctors and the police officers all sort of look at it like, "Oh, well, she's hysterical," or "She doesn't know what she's saying. She's emotional." And it hits that a little on the nose, but then it kind of loses that, I think, especially towards the end, where it's about like, well, then this happened and then this happened. We got to wrap it all into some sort of overarching narrative so that we can get it all in the movie, so that you know every single little bit of occurrence that went on related to this case. And it does kind of get away from itself, I think.
Yeah. And you mentioned the at the beginning when they're telling her that she's hysterical and just doesn't recognize her son. I think this is one of those stories where it has to be true to work. There were lots of lines that I don't think were meant to create huge laughs in the theater.
That's true. The audience was laughing a lot.
The audience laughed every time someone had something completely ridiculous to say.
Right.
Like, are you sure, you know, this isn't your son?
Right.
You know, he's been under a lot of stress. He might have shrunk in 3 inches. And everyone cracked up. But for her, she's, you know, the mother is freaking out during this period. So I don't think they were, you know, these were laugh moments.
No, but I think the fact that people did laugh at those moments, I mean, on the one hand, you're right, because it's true, then we can kind of buy into it.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I think this movie struck me in a lot of ways as not only taking place in the 30s, but almost being of the style of a sort of 30s women's picture melodrama. I think there was some review I read online that said this movie could have been made in 1938 and starred Betty Davis. And I think in a lot of ways that's true. That's aside from a handful of swear words and a bit of violence, it is very much a sort of black and white. She's good. The cops are evil. She's right. They're wrong. She weeps a lot, kind of thing. And I like movies from the 1930s, and I love Betty Davis. So I don't necessarily see that as inherently a criticism, but I think the sort of old-fashioned nature of it kind of detracts from what is probably a pretty complex story. I mean, with that parallel investigation you're talking about going on and things like that, that it sort of maybe oversimplifies it emotionally for the audience. Not only were people laughing at lines, but I think any time Angelina Jolie had any sort of triumph over the cops or whatever,
yeah,
people
would
cheer.
Yeah, they erupted cheers.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I agree that it does seem like a film from the 30s. And, of course, the look is completely authentic. And Angelina Jolie looks like she could be a leading lady in a Charlie Chaplin film.
Yeah.
But also, when I heard the premise for the film, it seems so very bleak and dark and terrible. And there are certainly depressing and frustrating moments. But overall, it was not nearly as depressing as I thought it would be, because there are so many, you know, stand up and cheer triumph moments.
There really are.
There are actually like a lot of one-liners in this movie where someone says something, you know.
A lot of zingers. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So that kind of surprised me a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I had mixed feelings about this. I think on the one hand, it seemed too simplistic to me, and it certainly is a little unfocused in that last half. But on the other hand, I think it pulls on those emotional strings well.
I think so too.
Sometimes sort of in spite of yourself, you know, where you're sort of, you know, the kind of thing where you might want to, you know, fight back tears and you think, this is ridiculous. This movie is, you know, very manipulative. But at the same time, it's successful at that. And I think especially Angelina Jolie really just constantly weeping throughout this movie kind of will get to you.
Yeah, it got to me. Even in the last 25 minutes when I was frustrated with some of the turns the film was taking, I don't want to give anything away, but there is a part where she starts screaming at this guy. And by like the third scream of the same question, I was just, I welled up a little.
Right, right. On the other hand, though, you can see her being like, I'm going to get an Oscar this time. I'm going to make it happen. I don't know. I mean, I was going to say I would give this movie like 2.5 stars, but I might bump it up to like 3 stars. I think, you know, almost like the Kevin Smith movie, if this is sort of within your particular taste, mm-hmm. If you like these sort of, you know, prestige melodramas, I guess we could call it. And Clint Eastwood has been making a lot of these kind of movies recently. I mean, this is a lot like Million Dollar Baby, which I thought was incredibly overrated.
I agree that Million Dollar Baby, any of those Paul Haggis projects, have sort of driven me up the wall.
Yes.
But I didn't think this was manipulative in that way that that drove me crazy in Million Dollar Baby and
right.
Crash.
Right. Oh, well, yeah, it's certainly not anything like Crash.
Yeah, no. So this movie didn't bother me in that way.
Yeah, yeah. So you would give it, a higher rating.
I'd give it maybe 3.5 stars.
3.5 stars, yeah. Yeah, so I don't know. I have some reservations, but I think it would be an interesting one to check out. Also opening this Friday is a movie that I know you haven't seen, but I unfortunately have, which is the latest Guy Ritchie vehicle called Rock and Rolla. And this is his sort of, like Kevin Smith, a return to form or an attempt to return to form, I think, in that the last couple movies he made, well, one was the Swept Away remake starring Madonna, and the last one, Revolver, was a sort of a gang. I mean, he's known for his sort of gangster convoluted plots and the
zany characters,
exactly,
and smash cuts,
right, right, and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch. Those were his big movies at the beginning of his career. And the last movie he did, Revolver, was about gangsters, but it was also about like metaphysics and the meaning of life and a lot of this sort of philosophical mumbo jumbo. And in fact, featured Deepak Chopra explaining the themes of the movie over the closing credits.
Wow.
So that was pretty painful. And this movie, slightly less so, I would say. It's back to the sort of meat and potatoes, gangsters double crossing each other, shooting people, etc., as in the earlier movies. But plot-wise, it's so convoluted. I think half the time I was wondering, like, what are these characters trying to do? And why are they after each other?
I think it doesn't matter to fans of these films. They're in it purely for the style and the adrenaline of the pace there. Because I had the same problem with both Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch.
Yeah. I think you're right, actually. Those movies are a little better because the style, I think, is more entertaining, or it's a little fresher, the dialogue that these characters spout, or there's their kind of wacky personality traits. And here, I think it just comes off as really tired and sort of played out. I think at this point, he's a little desperate, maybe, to sort of get back to why people liked him in the first place.
Mm.
And his British take on Tarantino is very transparent, especially, and there's a few visual touches. One scene where characters are talking, but their dialogue is being projected on the screen because you can't hear them. And there's a whole MacGuffin in this movie, which is this painting that everyone's after that you never see. You just see it from behind, or the characters look at it and they say, "Wow, that's amazing!" And it was very much like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. So I would love to say that this is, if you like those earlier movies, that this is sort of back to what he does well, which, as you say, he doesn't necessarily even do all that well. But it's not. It's just a mess, I think. And the saddest thing about this movie is that at the very end, there's a title on screen that says the characters will return in the real Rock and Rolla.
Ends with a threat.
Right, exactly, which I'm sort of dreading, although right now he's busy making a Sherlock Holmes movie with Robert Downey Jr., Guy Ritchie is. So.
Oh, that's right.
That could be something
different.
So I give Rock and Rolla 2 stars. I say skip that, especially because there's a couple other decent movies to see this week. Coming up on DVD... this coming Tuesday is Get Smart, the film version of the classic TV series, which I was a big fan of the TV series.
Oh, I see. I only vaguely remember it, so.
I think when I was a kid, I used to watch it on, like, Nick at Night or TV Land, and it's extremely silly, the show, which is, of course, is about this inept secret agent played by Don Adams on the TV show and played by Steve Carell in the new movie. And somehow through his bumbling, he always ends up solving the case. And mostly thanks to his partner, Agent 99, played by Anne Hathaway in the new movie, who's also his I think she's eventually his wife on the TV show, but they're just sort of romantically involved here. And she's super competent and he's super incompetent, but somehow the combination works.
They have this Inspector Gadget dynamic going on.
Exactly. Well, and Don Adams, of course, eventually went on to voice Inspector Gadget.
Yes.
And I think the show was very silly, was full of a lot of puns and a lot of sort of obvious gags that draw attention to the fact that they're obvious, which I kind of like that sort of humor, where it's weirdly self-deprecating. Mm-hmm. But the movie, I think, took itself way too seriously.
I remember around the time the film came out, they were discussing in interviews how they wanted to sort of play it like a Bourne film.
Right.
Like it was a straight up espionage thriller, but with these characters from the Get Smart TV show, which, I don't know, it's kind of a weird idea. And, I barely remember this movie.
I think that tells you something about this movie, that it was entirely forgettable. And I think, yeah, there's a lot of action sequences in this movie. I remember watching it, and there's some big car chase, and Steve Carell is jumping on top of semi-trucks. And I think, who thought it would be a good idea to make Steve Carell an action star?
Yeah, I remember there was a scene where, like, someone came in with machine guns, and they actually have, like, a physical fight, and there's no sort of clever joke way that they disarm them. They, like, honestly beat them. And I'm like, no, Steve Carell and Anne Hathaway. They're not action heroes.
They're certainly not. And the jokes are, I mean, they do recycle some bits and some lines from the original series, but it doesn't have the same panache to it, I would say. And I like Steve Carell. And I think he's a funny guy. And I like Anne Hathaway as an actor. She's, you know, she's charismatic. She's fun. But this movie just, it wasn't fun. It wasn't funny. I think I had a bad time watching it, which is not what you want out of a comedy.
I, again, have no recollection whatsoever.
All right, so forget that this movie is coming out. Don't even pay attention. I do want to recommend one movie also coming up on DVD on Tuesday, which is called Trans-Siberian, from director Brad Anderson, who's one of my favorite sort of under-the-radar cultish directors. He did a horror movie called Session 9, this sort of sci-fi romantic comedy, I guess you would call, called Happy Accidents, and made a movie called The Machinist with Christian Bale, where he lost like 90 pounds or something. It looked like he was about to break in half, but it was a very, very intense thriller. And this is another good, it's a very Hitchcockian thriller that takes place on the Trans-Siberian railway between Moscow and Beijing, I think it is. It's with Woody Harrelson and Emily Mortimer. They play an American couple coming back from missionary work, and they get caught up in all sorts of danger and intrigue. And Ben Kingsley plays a Russian cop who's sort of shady and investigating them. And it's not necessarily groundbreaking as a thriller, but it's well paced, it's exciting, and it's entertaining, well acted. And I think Brad Anderson is just a good, solid genre director. And this is the kind of movie that I think could have been huge. I mean, it's very mainstream, but for whatever reason, it was done on a more independent level and, you know, kind of went under the radar in theaters. But I think it's definitely one to check out on DVD, certainly over Get Smart.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, check out Trans-Siberian coming up on DVD on Tuesday. And check out Zack and Miri and or Changeling, I think, in theaters, both flawed but interesting movies.
If it's your kind of movie, you'll probably appreciate it.
Yes, so. I think so. Okay, thank you very much, Matthew Scott Hunter, for joining me this week.
Thanks for having me.
And for Las Vegas Weekly, I'm Josh Bell, and tune in next week.
Josh Bell hates everything except me.